May it please the Court, Carl Hill of Seitzman, Archrub & Green, here on behalf of the appellants, the surviving children of Mrs. Beverly Taylor. In this matter, there are essentially in dispute two what have been described as infiltrations or extravasations that occurred on November 29, 2007 and December 19, 2007, about 20 days apart. I thought it would be helpful to identify what's not in dispute and what has been conceded by the defendant appellee, which I think helps frame the two issues that are before your honors today. The appellee concedes that in respect to the November 29, 2007 infiltration, that Mrs. Taylor's daughter, Melinda, overheard a defendant nurse say that there had been an infiltration at the conclusion of that chemotherapy session on the 29th and that harmful drugs had invaded the body of Mrs. Taylor. And the defendant concedes furthermore that according to Mrs. Swanky, who is the expert that's a dispute in respect to today's proceedings, that this infiltration on the 29th of November was caused by needle dislodgement and that the standard of care required the defendant nurses to follow a certain protocol, which she identified in her letter report and in her later deposition. And that protocol essentially, and I'll refer to it as a protocol after I describe it briefly, was to report to the physician, document the problem, assess and treat, and to educate the patient in respect to signs and symptoms of the leaking of the chemo drugs into the body. And that the standard of care was breached because the protocol was not followed. That's all conceded by the defendant in its papers and starting with the motion in limine, which is a part of the record before your honors. Secondly, the defendant concedes that the second extravasation or infiltration, which occurred 20 days later, that infiltration required a plastic surgeon to perform at least four surgeries to debride or to attempt to remove the contaminated or dead or dying, also referred to as necrotic tissue, and that the December infiltration was the cause of Mrs. Taylor's death. And that was conceded at the oral argument before Judge Tolliver, and that's found on page A110 of the appendix. And finally, there's no dispute as to the standard of review on these issues, and that is reading the opinions of Nurse Swanky's testimony as a whole, drawing all reasonable inferences and all facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff as a whole, were her opinions sufficiently reliable to be presented to the jury? And to us, Your Honor, we believe that they were in fact and that they should have been provided to a jury in this case. Thus, the issues are only whether her testimony as a whole established causation as it related to the November infiltration and whether the opinions satisfy the breach of the standard of care as it relates to the December infiltration. And those are the two issues that are before your honors. And put another way, based on this record, should her opinions be tested by a jury? And we've cited cases, I think both sides, but I've cited cases like Vogel, which is a Superior Court case, where Judge Stokes said the speculation issue should be grist for the jury mill. That was his language. McCusker, a district court case, which was decided on a motion for a new trial after a jury verdict in favor of the plaintiff, wherein Judge Jordan decided that assumptions are perfectly acceptable by an expert and that an expert doesn't know.
Could I interrupt for a second?
Surely.
Because we're reasonably familiar with the case law. Doesn't it really boil down to what there is in the record? And on the first point, we've got the concession that there was a violation of the standard of care as to what was done. But what is there that you can point to that establishes causation?
A couple things, Your Honor. The letter report, which was identified as an exhibit to the motion in limine, it's found at pages A27 to 30 of the appendix. It was also attached as the first exhibit of Ms. Swanky's deposition. It's a 3- or 4-page letter, and in that letter, there's great detail as to the cause, since we've got an assumed and an agreed breach of fiduciary duty, the cause of the damage relating to the failure to follow the protocol or the standard of care. And what
Can you just read to me some language, some paragraph, whatever, that says, you know, because the 1129 procedure was improperly done, this is what happened that was a damage to this patient?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. And this is mainly focused on the pages of her deposition. The letter report does summarize the fact that the amount of damage that a patient receives when these harmful chemical drugs get into a body is directly related to the management of the infiltration, and that, of course, the standard of care requires an immediate assessment and review, et cetera, et cetera. That's the protocol. And what she said in her deposition to amplify that was that that hospitalization may not have even been required if the nurses had followed the protocol, that there's no dispute whatsoever in this record that Mrs. Taylor experienced after the infiltration, which is conceded as to the November session, pain, swelling, redness, burning, et cetera, after she was sent home from the procedure. And at, again, those pages, A74 to A76 are her deposition, and she basically said that the sequelae, that's her words, which means the swelling, the pain, the tissue necrosis, exactly what she said, and the overall damage would have been minimized, and that's on page A75 and 76.
Okay, well, let's make it simpler. Is there any claim here that the actual procedure, as opposed to what was done after the procedure, that the procedure constituted a breach of the standard of care, that whoever placed the needle in her or set this up was negligent?
No.
Okay. So what I take from that is that when you do this kind of a procedure, there is a risk that it's going to result in this infiltration, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the problem then is, according to your position, the problem is that there was this unfortunate result, which was not malpractice, but there was an unfortunate result, and it was not properly handled. And that's where the problem is. Got that. And I understand there was swelling, there was pain. All of that was as a result of having the procedure go wrong. But that's not a damage that's related to malpractice, correct?
Well, Your Honor, yes. The direct answer is you're correct.
Okay, wait. Let me just kind of play it out, okay? All right, so then the next question becomes, if something had been done about it immediately, which is what your expert is testifying, it would be the standard of care. What could have been done immediately that would have relieved the pain, the swelling, the long-term adverse results of this infiltration?
The answer to that question, Your Honor, is we have as an assumed fact that the nurse, one of the defendant nurses, noticed when she was taking the needle out of the port on the 29th of November that there was an infiltration.
Gotcha.
That triggers the standard of care, which you just talked about. And the testimony is that ultimately you have 4 surgeries starting December 28th, I think, through January, I think, 10th or 12th.
But that's after a second one of these.
That's after a second one. But the tissue necrosis and the damage to that tissue was occurring all along.
Mr. Hill, let me
just, Your Honor.
You know, try to follow up and maybe ask Justice Berger's question in a different way. We understand that the theory of breach of the standard of care is that once these sequelae were discovered, there should have been an immediate follow-up, and there wasn't.
Correct.
The question is, if there had been an immediate follow-up, what then would have occurred differently from what actually occurred in terms of the course of treatment or any of the other events that followed?
And
the specific question is, what is the expert's testimony on that?
The expert's testimony is, and this is reflected in her report and in her deposition, is that upon an immediate alert to the fact that there had been an infiltration, okay? And by the way, there's really no dispute for this record that the nurse believed that the needle became dislodged, and that was the cause of the infiltration. But what she said is that if a doctor had known, if the nurses had identified the problem immediately, then a doctor would have been able at that point in time to stop the process of these drugs leaching into the body and destroying tissue. And that is in a fair reading of her report on page 3. I think it's on 829 in the record. And in her deposition, I think it pages A74 and A75 of the record.
Okay, well, wait a second. If that's the case, are you saying that they do this procedure, a nurse sees that there's infiltration, the chemicals, the chemotherapy chemicals, are still pouring into the person's body, and nobody is turning off the spigots, so to speak, even though once you learn that there's an infiltration, that's one of the first things you need to do. Is that correct?
Correct, and that you need to call a doctor immediately and say, we have an infiltration, because that's what the record reflects happened on the 29th. Doctor, we have an infiltration. We need to start something immediately, and that is what the nurse is testifying about.
Can you read the exact language, both on that page of the report and the deposition that you were referring to?
Well, I can read a quote from the deposition, which is on A74, where Nurse Swanky said that the amount of damage relates to the management of the extravasation. And in and around those pages,
where does she say that if there had been an immediate follow-up, a doctor would have taken a look at the site and essentially stopped the process or done something different? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think it's on that same page, Your Honor, and it's A74 of the record.
Which says what?
Which she is testifying that if the protocol were followed.
No, can you read it?
Your Honor,
I paraphrase it.
Okay.
And I'm also interested in what the report says.
Okay. Okay, I'm looking at page, it's A73 at the bottom. I want you to assume that on November 29th, the oncologist nurse had contacted a physician. Would Beverly Taylor have been admitted to the hospital any sooner? You see what I'm driving at? If you don't, tell me. She said, I don't. But then there was testimony, and Your Honor, I can't point to it right now other than I can tell you that she talked about an A74 to A76 that it had been managed appropriately, she would not have been hospitalized. And that is in the deposition testimony of Nurse Swink.
So that's like saying if she had been, there had been proper follow-up, the problem would have gone away, but there's no detail.
Yeah, and Your Honor,
was there any detail in the report?
Other than the testimony that I've just given you, the reference that I've just given you, that she linked the immediate contact of the physician as a part of the standard of care to how much damage would be presented if that protocol wasn't followed. That's the best I can.
There was no detail in the report.
Not to the extent that you've directly asked. And I have to concede
and what
that.
What about a doctor? It seems to me that if you're talking about what should have happened after there was this problem and the infiltration, the nurse is saying a doctor should have come right away and looked at it. Is there any testimony from a doctor saying that in these circumstances I would have done X and it would have you know, reduced the amount of swelling or improved her condition faster or anything like that?
Not from a doctor, Your Honor, not in this record. What you have is the testimony about minimizing the damage by immediately triggering the protocol. You have the testimony that's undisputed that there was significant tissue necrosis down the line just 25 or 26 days later that required the surgery. And, you know, in our opinion, when you look at the standard to allow a witness to testify, that when you consider everything as a whole, the testimony is sufficient to be heard by a jury.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
Yes.
But it seems that there is a big gap. That is, well, in effect, what we're being told is that the witness said, look, if this had been brought to a doctor's attention, as soon as the Ms. Taylor reported symptoms, then the doctor would have done something to fix it, period, without getting into what could or would have been done.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair comment, Your Honor. And now, I think I'm into my rebuttal time. I think I have 3 minutes and 45 seconds. But I just wanted to state as to the December infiltration, which we haven't got to yet, we believe it's pretty clear based on the last two paragraphs of her letter report, which we contend should be considered as a part of the whole of her opinions, and the deposition testimony that I've cited in the brief, that she clearly said that the protocol that she identified as to the first extravasation was the same protocol that should have been followed, and therefore that establishes the standard of care for purposes of allowing an expert to be heard before a jury. And that, of course, the defendant concedes that the death of Mrs. Taylor was, in fact, caused by the December extravasation. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Elzafan for the appellee. I'd like to first address two points that Justice Berger and Mr. Hill went through, because I think there may be an inadvertent misinterpretation of the records. Your Honor asked whether or not the time of this first extravasation, which we concede is negligent for the appeal periods only, was there a continuous, I think it was where the spigot wasn't being turned off or something of that effect. It was. The way it works is the nurse noticed the infiltration, if we accept plaintiff's version is true, as she was removing the needle. The needle was gone. The drugs were not going in. Also, it's very important that the drugs that caused the damages here, if you look at page A33 of the appendix, it will show the order in which the drugs were administered. It started at 9:50 in the morning. It went to 3:10 in the afternoon. And the ones in the middle, Adriamycin and Vincristine, those are the offending drugs. Those are the probable offending drugs. So it's not a case where the nurse notices there's an infiltration and these drugs are still pouring into the system. The spigot, so to speak, had been cut off when the infiltration was noted.
Well, that's all well and good, but if the standard of care requires that a doctor immediately come and review the patient's condition in light of the infiltration, and that didn't happen because nobody notified the doctor, doesn't that raise at least a reasonable inference that something could have been done? Why call a doctor if you've already pulled out the needle, so no more drugs are going in, and there's nothing you can do anyhow at this point?
Well, what you can't, well, taking the plaintiff's theory is the infiltration has occurred. I have an infiltration. I need to do something about it.
Right.
Their theory is nothing was done. And it's conceded no doctor was called that day. But what the record does reflect, undisputed, and by the way, something that the plaintiff's expert didn't even know about, I brought her to the attention, is the infiltration occurred on the 29th. The 30th, she comes back to a new last injection to reverse the chemotherapy. No problems noted that day by anybody. On the 1st, there's some problems noted. She's at home, Mrs. Taylor's home, and the nurse, visiting nurse, not an employee of ROPA, a visiting nurse, calls the oncologist and said, hey, we have a situation here. What do I do? And the oncologist, according to the plaintiff themselves, tells the nurse, watch it. If it gets worse, then bring it to the hospital. If it doesn't get worse, then don't worry about it. And that, of course, and of course, it got worse, and they brought her in the next day. And there's, and that's why we can say with confidence that when we asked Karen Swienke about this in deposition, and I said, you know, would earlier notification to the doctor, would administration of the extravasation protocol have made a difference in the hospitalization? Would it have changed anything? She said, I don't know. And that doesn't get to the jury.
Well, I understand what you're telling us was that, you know, the claim here is that as soon as these symptoms presented, then a doctor should have been notified.
That is
your
the claim.
Your response is a doctor was notified. And
plaintiffs
the doctor
conceded.
Said, continue to watch it, and if it gets worse, bring her back. Is that correct?
That is the record, yes, sir.
But at the same time, I understand that your side concedes that what happened, at least in connection with the first infiltration, was a breach of the standard of care.
We are assuming, for the purpose of argument, that there was an infiltration and that the extravasation protocol, which was not administered, which was not implemented, should have been implemented. We are conceding that for this purpose. But the and we that's the negative.
But actually, you're arguing that the protocol was implemented as soon as it could be. That's there seems to be, you know, your factual argument that you just made to us and this concession seemed to go in completely opposite directions.
Well, the concession had a bunch of things. The plaintiffs, the argument of standard of care by Nurse Bianchi says that Melinda Moss should have been educated, that the patient should have been educated. There's a whole bunch of things that were part of the extravasation protocol, one of which was the doctor being notified. And because of the concession that was made, because of the doctor's testimony, and because of the concession, the testimony that she didn't know how it would have made a difference, I didn't parse it out to that degree. So if there's an inconsistency, it's because of that. And if it confuses the court, then my apology.
Okay, so the she on her deposition, the nurse said, I don't know.
Correct.
Your legal argument, therefore, must be that if the nurse is going to be the source of the expert testimony, she has to be able to articulate some procedure that would have been followed that's different from what actually occurred.
And she, and it,
correct?
And more, yes, and more important, in addition to that, she must be able to articulate how it would have made a difference. And specifically, you know, she needed to be able to articulate how it would have been that if a doctor had been called on the 29th as opposed to the 1st, how it would have made a difference. If the doctor called the 30th as opposed to the 1st, how it would have made a difference. How anything would have made a difference. And she couldn't, she didn't know. And in a medical negligence case, especially one where you're accusing a defendant of causing the death of another, that needs to be established. And she didn't know. And it's nowhere in her report. The report doesn't go into that. The report, you can read the report speaks for itself. And my position is the report can be read and reread and read and reread, and it doesn't supply the missing information. The affidavit of merit, which technically should not be before the court, but I'm okay with the court looking at it, doesn't supply that either.
What does the certificate of death say?
Chemical burn. Death due to chemical burn. And that gets into, and that's what the certificate of death says.
So now that relates to one of these two incidents, right?
Our position is the chemical burn has to be related to the second incident because she was discharged on December, admitted December 2nd, discharged December 14th, and she was sent home, and the orders were that you can have more chemotherapy. Well, the only logical conclusion, and there's no evidence to the contrary, that if they're worried about a chemical burn from an extravasation and chemotherapy, they're not going to put her subjected to another round. So, nobody is accusing the people who treat her from the 2nd to 14th to have done anything but proper care.
So, is it your position that the record demonstrates after the first incident there was no chemical burn?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is to the extent there was a chemical burn, there probably was some chemical burn, it was treated, it was taken care of, it was over because she went to the hospital for treatment of that and they sent her home. Discharged December and ordered, and the doctors caring for her, not my people, the doctors caring for her said when you, on the 19th, get another round of chemicals.
Well, there can be more than one proximate cause. When you say they wouldn't have gone forward if they weren't satisfied with the way they treated the first chemical burn, the plan for the second treatment was to keep it all in the right place, wasn't it?
The plan for the second treatment as it was in the first one.
And that didn't happen the second time?
We don't know that. There's a huge dispute about whether or not there was an extravasation the second time. For the purpose of this argument, we have to concede, based on this record, the fact of the extravasation.
Well, that's where I'm confused about the record, because if the argument is there was no second chemical burn, and we know there was a first chemical burn, and she died from a chemical burn, where does that leave us?
Then my argument wasn't well put forth in the brief, which is on my shoulders. Is the argument is, for the purpose of the appeal, there is an assumption that there was a burn, a second extravasation.
But more than that, you're not only assuming it, you're assuming that the second incident, the second chemical burn, and only the second chemical burn was the cause of death.
Correct. For the purpose of appeal, yes, and there's no evidence to the contrary from the plaintiffs. Because if there was an assertion by the plaintiffs that proper treatment as the time of the first chemical burn were there, it would have affected and made a difference in her hospital course. And she said, I don't know. Now, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's our position.
I understand.
Okay. May I proceed?
Sure.
Okay. And as to the second one, I think it's important to point out that no place did the plaintiff's expert suggest that the mere fact of an extravasation is negligent. At no time was it either for either one. For the first one, there's all sorts of things that should have been done, and she had a theory of how it was done. The theory of how the first one occurred was needle dislodgement. That theory doesn't work for the second one because it's conceded by the plaintiff on page B31, lines 1 through 6 of page 56 of the plaintiff's deposition. The second one, the needle was taped, so there could not be a needle dislodgement. So she didn't know how the second one occurred. And therefore, the mere fact of an extravasation doesn't fall under one of the statutory exceptions, which the court is equally familiar with than I am. So she has to come up with a reason why it occurred. Now, I'm aware of the fact that there are other cases cited by the plaintiff, such as Balin and McCusker, where the physician, the plaintiff's expert, did not know exactly how something occurred. But they're distinguishable with this one. In Balin, the expert there, Dr. Levinson, said, look, I don't know how the trocar ended up where it was, but it was in the wrong position. So however it happened, it was wrong. In McCusker, the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Richmond, said the bone was driven into the spinal canal, and I don't know how it was driven there, but that was wrong. Here, Mrs. Swianke, as the second one, said, I don't know what happened. And then she stopped, and it was not bolstered. If she had said, I don't know what happened, but any extravasation is per se negligent, then I don't have an answer. It goes to the jury. But she didn't say that. The only thing she ever said, in fact, at one point, she said, going back to something else, this is important. At one point, she says, not all extravasations need to go to the hospital. I can cite that if you give me a moment. I remember that. She said that right away. Not all extravasations need to go to the hospital. And that's more important for number one. Let's see if I can get that real quickly. Not every patient who gets an extravasation needs to go to the hospital. Page 47 of her deposition, appendix page A74. I think that's critical for both of them. So in essence, what we have here, and going back to it, is what I hope I've articulated well in the brief. And you have to answer the question.
Let me go back to trying to nail down some of these facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's focus on the second procedure on December 19th.
Yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me just a moment. It's important for the people in the audience to pay attention to the court and not be talking to each other and joking. And if anyone has difficulty in doing that, now would be the time to leave the argument. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the procedure on the 19th of December.
Yes.
This one, you agree for present purposes, was a cause of death, ultimately, that it resulted in four surgeries and ultimately death because of chemical burn, correct?
For these purposes,
okay,
yes.
Fine. So with respect to the December 19th procedure, what you're saying is there's no evidence that anybody breached a standard of care.
Yes.
Okay. Isn't there indication that on the 19th, again, nobody immediately alerted a doctor and went through the protocol?
That is true. However, when Swienke was pressed on the issue of what happened on the 19th, as to what, when I asked her what happened, and where things went wrong, the only thing she could talk about was documentation. Wasn't documented.
Well, doesn't that lead to a fair inference that it wasn't done?
What she said was the extravasation wasn't documented. Oh, the inference that a doctor wasn't called on the 19th?
Right.
That's no inference. Doctor wasn't called on the 19th. We can see that fact. Absolutely. That's not even an inference.
Wait a second. Back up. December 19th, you're agreeing for present purposes that there was an infiltration.
Correct.
Extravagation.
Correct.
Fine. And you're now agreeing that, for present purposes at least, on December 19th, no doctor was called.
I'll always agree to that because it is a fact. No doctor was called.
Okay, good. And what the nurse, the expert nurse said was standard of care requires that when there's an infiltration, one of the things that has to be done immediately is have a doctor assess it.
That assumes that the extravasation was noticeable on the day that it occurred. And there's no evidence from that nurse that extravasations are always noticeable on the day that they occurred. And there's no evidence. You can have the fact of an infiltration / extravasation, but not notice of it. You know, something happened on the 19th. We know that. But there's no evidence in this record that the plaintiffs can point to, the nurse can point to, the nurse can infer that on the 19th it was known to the nurse. That distinguishes November, where the nurse said, I must have a little infiltration here. She knew it right then and there. That corresponding piece of evidence doesn't exist for the 29th. The 29th, she went in and she went home.
All right. Well, then let me put it this way. Is there anything in this record that says when this type of infiltration happens, sometimes you can tell and sometimes you can't tell?
I think not, but I'm not 100% sure right now. The only one I do know is the statement that I cited earlier, that an infiltration does not necessarily mean one has to go to the hospital. But I don't, if the question is, did the plaintiff's expert, or is there anything in the record which says when an infiltration occurs, it may be noticeable. If it's in the record, it's not ringing a bell off the top of my head right now.
All right, so the symptoms were not noticeable on the day that the second infiltration took place.
There's no evidence they were, because they came and came out.
But they were, at some point they did present.
2 days later, later.
And the nurse found out about it.
What happened on the second one is...
found out about it.
Sir?
Who discovered it?
Oh, the plaintiff of the family.
Okay, what happened then?
Second extravasation the 19th, she went to the hospital 2 days later. The 22nd, she went to the hospital. Family took her to the hospital. It was bad. However bad it was on the day of the infiltration, on the day of the second administration chemo, which was the 19th, by the 22nd, it had gotten demonstrably worse, and they called up the hospital, and they got a direct admit. But she was admitted on the 22nd.
All right, so what is the issue as to the second procedure.
Yes, sir.
Was whether the standard of care was breached.
Correct. The only issue.
You argued that it wasn't?
Correct.
Or at least there was no prima facie evidence of it because?
Because the nurse had, because there's no evidence in the record that an extravasation is per se negligent. The fact of it means there was something done wrong. The only thing she said was if there's a needle dislodgement, but that's the first one. And when I pressed her, how did it occur? She did not know. And if you don't, if something is not per se wrong, if and you don't know how something occurred, I don't know how it occurred, then you, our position is if you don't know how something happened, you can't testify that there was negligent conduct. This is not a situation such as the Froyo case or the Simmons case where they were conditional. In the Simmons case, the yes and no is based on whether the patient was or was not alert. It was either it was this way or that way determined which way the evidence went. In the Froyo case, it was whether the hospital should have known this patient needed extra care. They were conditional opinions. This isn't a conditional opinion. She did not say, well, if this happened, it's negligent, but if this happened, it did negligent. I said, how did it happen? And she said, I don't know. And it's not my burden to go beyond that.
And wait a second, let's follow up on that. The nurse doesn't know how the December 19th infiltration happened.
Correct.
But you are conceding that it did happen.
For the appeal purposes, I am conceding, yes, that it did happen.
And you're also conceding that there was no doctor called immediately, which the nurse indicated is part of the proper standard of care.
If they know about the infiltration.
And as to that point, it appears that there is nothing in the record either way.
It's blank. Well, no, it's not blank because the testimony of Melinda Moth was at the time of the first infiltration, the nurse mentioned something. The testimony of Melinda Moth, the second infiltration, was nothing. Nothing was said. Nothing was noticed. She went in. She got her she got her chemo. She went home. The next day, they went in. They got the Neulasta, and she went home. And then 2 days later, that's when it got worse and into the hospital in response to what Justice Jacobs asked. So there is a factual difference.
Thank you.
Oh, I see I'm red. Thank you, Your Honors.
I'll be very brief. I think Mr. Elzafan said that the testimony or the record reflects that Mrs. Taylor was treated for the first infiltration. And I just want to direct Your Honors and refer to the discharge summary. The discharge summary is at 855 of the appendix. And in that record, the treating physician, Dr. Falchak, wrote, I spoke with the nurses at the Helen F. Graham Cancer Center who administered the treatment, and they assured me that there was no possibility that her adriamycin and vincristine, which would be vesciants, had extravasated. So that's what the discharge summary shows, which shows that they did not treat for the extravasation. And that's the point really behind Nurse Swanky's overall testimony. And finally, a couple different points.
Yes, so you're talking about the December discharge summary.
December 14th, I think it was, Your Honor. And secondly, the assumption, and we have as an admitted fact for purposes of the argument, that a second one occurred in December. And there's reference in Dr. Malik's operative report after one of his debridements, and that's at A57 of the record, where he identifies the fact that a second extravasation occurred. And that when you read the deposition testimony of Nurse Swanky, it's quite clear that she was assuming that and was trying to say, I wasn't there, but I see in the record that one occurred.
That's fine, but there seems to be a gap here, at least with respect to if the infiltration occurred and everybody agrees that it occurred in December, it's still not apparent whether that would have been something that in the exercise of proper care, anybody would have noticed immediately. And if nobody noticed it immediately and that was not an act of negligence not to notice it, then there was no protocol to put in place until somebody realized that there was a second infiltration.
And that's a fair point on this record, but when looking at this as a whole and looking at the testimony and what facts we do have, and remember Dr. Malik, who treated and did the surgeries, he wasn't even deposed prior to this decision by the Superior Court. And, you know, Ms. Swanky's testimony, her very first deposition, you know, it was a discovery deposition. So the I understand the scenario, and I appreciate what the defendant did in connection with the motion. But that's the procedure when this case was dismissed.
But wouldn't you agree
about a month before
that there's
trial?
A gap here?
There's a gap, but I think the testimony that in light of this history of the patient, I think a fair inference is that the protocol needed to be kicked in on the second one.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.